Hey kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hey kids, do you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too. This is Shake Them Ropes. I am Jeff Hawkins, firmly entrenched in the internet bubble. He is Chris Novembrino, firmly not entrenched in the internet bubble. Personal note, rest in peace to comedic genius Richard Lewis, who passed away yesterday. I met Richard Lewis once here in LA at a gig because he was still tight with David Brenner, who I opened for, and I was possibly going to write for him on this big comeback that never really materialized because David Brenner, time had passed him by, as had his sense of humor, and it was terrible. It's like writing for Mort Saul in the 90s. It just wasn't going to work out. But in the 80s, when I was studying stand-up, you know, and all that dude, Richard Lewis was just awesome to me. Neurotic, great. If you've ever seen any of his laters with Bob Costas, they're some of the best that they did in the mid-90s when Costas had a talk show late at night before. Who was it that ruined that? Greg Kinnear ruined that show so bad. Was on modern people would know him from Curb Your Enthusiasm these days. Just a prince of a man in every sense of the word. Are you familiar with the stand-up of Richard Lewis?
I am. I mean, he used to be on Comedy Central a lot, especially back in the 90s.
He used to have the piano, and he'd always use it as a cheat to spread his notes out so he could read his jokes type of a thing.
No, I mean, he was a very, you know, like, he's like kind of like the quintessential steady hand in comedy.
And the thing to me that was always funny was he was neurotic, but all his comedy was about having sex. You know, it's always like, yeah, I was sleeping with this woman. He'd always talk with his hands and stuff like that. He'd always be like, and I'm really nervous about being naked because, you know, all this other thing. I'm like, dude, you are getting laid more than most comedians. What are you talking about?
He always had a good look, you know. Yeah, he had a mullet. Put together look. Yeah, that mullet.
The sitcom he did in the 80s called Anything But Love with Jamie Lee Curtis was sneaky good for a couple seasons and then just kind of fell off. But also good in Men in Tights, the Mel Brooks movie, Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yeah, so that's just your little comedy thing before we go into the wrestling passings this week, of which there were two major ones, for at least for my fandom, and at least one for Chris's, I think. Starting with Ole Anderson, former Alan Rogowski, original member of the Four Horsemen, passed away at the age of 81. Trained by Vern Gagne, part of that kind of trifecta of Gene Lars and Ole Anderson, of which Gene Anderson was the only actual Anderson. Everybody else were kayfabe brothers. Most famous for, the tag team with Gene in both the North Carolina / Crockett and Georgia territories, where he also booked both territories simultaneously in the early 80s. Especially making North Carolina just the tag team wrestling territory for America, which traveled into the late 80s into the 90s eventually. Also infamous for being the one holdout on Black Saturday when the Briscoes, that being Jack and Jerry, not Mark and Jay, but the old Briscoes, the original Briscoes and Gary Barnett, yes, sold their shares of championship wrestling from Georgia, Georgia Championship Wrestling, GCW, to Vince McMahon. And Vince McMahon showed up on TBS. some interesting stories there, especially Vince meeting with Ole, and Ole basically telling Vince F you and F your wife when he brought Linda to meet him. Much like the old school guys, you know, to me, Ole Anderson, quintessential wrestler from that, you know, big, burly, looked like your dad, even if he was only like 29. Always looked like he was about 45. Tough, looked like you didn't want to meet him in a bar kind of thing. I've watched some shoots of him. I've read a little bit of his book, and much like a lot of promoters that go by the wayside, there's a lot of bitterness there. And a lot of good ideas, but a lot of, you can see the blind spots in his thinking in a lot of things. Like he is a big size guy. He is a big toughness guy, 'cause he comes from that Vern Gagne school of, you know, everybody should look like Dick the Bruiser type of a thing. He's a big believer that heels shouldn't leave their feet or bump that much for baby faces, which kind of started to really go the wrong way when he got into the mid-80s and the Rock and Roll Express. There was a bit of a styles clash there at first until, you know, until they kind of came to a bit of an agreement there. He was a guy that thought, you know, he'll say publicly, you know, if you had to travel from territory to territory, you were worthless, because you should stay in one territory and just, if you make a lot of money, stay there and continue things. But he was also a guy that, you know, he did Florida and the AWA a couple times, and Georgia and North Carolina. So, I mean, he kind of bounced back and forth, at least on the Eastern Seaboard. And he also did Japan, I think, once too. I remember there's a matchup between him and Tenryu from like 90, I think. That's kind of amazing. His philosophy on tag team wrestling was, you know, work a leg or work an arm, work a body part over, and get a submission if you can, or get the pin, et cetera, et cetera. That culminated in the Crockett era during those times. But I mean, he was also a guy that didn't see any money in both Ricky Steamboat nor Hulk Hogan at the time, which is amazing to think, especially Ricky Steamboat, who in 1982 had one of the biggest tag team feuds in Crockett. This is after Ole stopped booking the Crockett territory, with Jay Youngblood versus Don Kernodle and Sergeant Slaughter. Which, and of course, he sent Hogan away from when he was Sterling Golden from Georgia, basically gave him to, I think, Vern, and then later he went from Vern to Vince, as Hulk Hogan just didn't see any money in him. He was against things like national expansion. He thought, you know, once companies went national, it was bad, because you could have like 100 companies in smaller areas and make a lot of money versus just one big one where you're never working the road. That was obviously wrong. And he was also one of the guys to scoff at Vince when Vince told him about pay-per-view and what that would be, and having, you know, a million homes paying, you know, $40 for a pay-per-view. He infamously railed against that. If you've ever watched his shoots, he didn't think anybody but him or people like him could work. You know, he liked Arn, kind of liked Ric Flair for a while, but then he said, oh, he just patterns his mind. He's one of those guys who, when he's in charge, he wants people like him. And it's one of those things where, you know, you kind of see why. I mean, but he was pure, you know, came from the time when it was kayfabe and it was all about money and you didn't want to do too much type of a thing, which also eventually went by the wayside. His promos were fantastic, and some of his angles, if you've never seen The Great Turn of 1980, I know Dave on Wrestling Observer Radio kind of poo-pooed it a little bit because it was the second feud with Dusty, but The Great Turn of 1980 is one of the best angles ever done, I think, in my opinion. His interviews with the Horsemen, if you don't know The Great Turn of 1980, that's when he had turned babyface. And Dusty Rhodes eventually came to him to help him battle the Assassins and Ivan Koloff. And there were two special referees in the match. There was, I believe it was Gene, not Lars Anderson, and Ivan Koloff were special referees. The Assassins picked Ivan Koloff. And of course, Ole picked his brother. And they're in a cage. And eventually, everybody just turns and beats up Dusty. And the promo afterwards, where he's explaining it, where it's like, he asked me, I can't believe it. Ole had a certain fire to his promos, and a certain realness to his promos. When he told you in Crockett, when he was part of the Horsemen, that 1986 at some time, Dusty Rhodes is going to announce his retirement, you kind of believed it. You know, his promos against Piper in Georgia are fantastic. He always had a weird, angry fire that was believable. And I love him as a promo. His wrestling, I had to get used to, and eventually I did, once you learn that older style that he had brought into the 80s. As a child of the 80s, you kind of like watching Rock and Roll Express and all these guys flying around the place and things like that. And it's like, you know, I think his hatred of Dusty Rhodes in real life, in terms of I don't want to like run into his elbow because that looks stupid, was more of a pride thing. I think he was very bitter he didn't make a lot of money as a horseman, because I think he was promised a lot more merchandising and things like that that never really came to fruition. Comes off as bitter a lot of times, but as a performer, more than a booker, I absolutely came to adore Ole Anderson. Once I started doing more of a deep dive into his early 80s / late 70s stuff, the stuff with the Horsemen is great, but yeah, he never did any of the reunions with the Horsemen. He hated Vince McMahon until his dying breath, which is kind of awesome in some ways to be that embittered. But he also just didn't like anybody else either, it would appear. Even people he worked with for a while. Chris, I think Ole might have been after your time, but do you have, any recollections of Ole Anderson? Maybe even like the early 90s when he came back with the Horsemen to face JTex?
So recently I went on YouTube and I was actually watching Ole Anderson shoot videos where he was talking specifically about Ric Flair. And
yeah.
All of his points about Ric Flair, they are contrarian takes, but when you start stringing them together, like, he has a worldview. It makes sense.
Makes sense to him, but at the same time, Flair has a pattern match that he does, but it's a great pattern, you know?
I it's reductive, but like, I also get what, you know, like, it's not a horrible argument.
No.
And then like, I also do just, you gotta, especially as time goes on, give mad respect to anyone who said F you for the rest of your life to Vince McMahon.
Yeah, that was
right. Like that's an all time great take. Like that's a pretty strong and awesome take on Ole Anderson's part.
Yeah, yeah, but he burned those bridges. Like, he got fired from Crockett, or actually WCW. He was trying to get his kid into the business, and Eric Bischoff comes in and fires his son, who's a trainee at the power plant, and so he's trying to get his son a job somewhere. So he brings in Jim Cornette to a meeting at the power plant. Now, this is post Watts, and Bischoff catches wind of this, and he and Cornette didn't get along. So he fires Ole right on the spot too, for bringing Cornette onto WCW territory. So of course, Ole hates Bischoff with every ounce of his being as well. Yeah. I remember watching Ole heel videos as a kid. And then you watch Ole as a babyface, and they're the same promo, but they're still awesome as a babyface too. That's having a great character and sticking with it.
I agree.
Yeah. Matches to watch. For me, I would say the Andersons versus the Rock and Roll Express at, I think it was Starrcade 85. Don't quote me on that one though. Yeah, Ole's great in every. I mean, watch his Georgia stuff. Watch his team with Stan Hansen in Georgia, because those guys just absolutely killed it down there. You know, watch the great turn of 80. If you can find any footage of him and Gene versus Paul Jones and Wahoo McDaniel, Ole and Wahoo McDaniel is always just two grizzled big dudes who just beat the crap out of each other. That is a hoss fight. That those are always fun. Any interaction between Wahoo, who was just semi-alcoholic and just didn't give a crap, but was tough as nails, and Ole, who was also semi-alcoholic and tough as nails, just watch those two just beat the crap out of each other for 10 minutes, and you'll be happy. But yeah. Also passing away this week, Mike Jones, a.k.a. Virgil, a.k.a. Soul Train Jones, but best known as the valet for the Million Dollar Man and his run in the WWF. Originally, part trivia, I was told, or at least it was on Wikipedia, that he was a graduate of the University of Virginia, and there is a Mike Jones with a degree in math who matches his age. It says on his Wikipedia, Virginia Union. I'm not so sure. I still think he went to UVA, but...
But there's also questions about the man's age too,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Some said born in 62. Some said 51. I was like, I don't think there's that big of a difference. I would go with the 62. I think that's a good number. But yeah, more or less a running joke the last 20 years of a guy, you know, trying to pull the old. I hesitate to say carny because I got a comment from someone that we didn't post about being insulted by the term carny. But yeah, no, he was always trying to work for money. Let's put it that way. He'd show up to FanFest when he wasn't booked and set up a table with merch. If you ever talk to him, the first thing he'd do is hit you up for money. And if you asked a question, he'd then hit you up for money again and they'd upsell you. He's that kind of a guy. Never much of a wrestler to me. Great athleticism.
No. Oh, I don't say that. How could you say that? I mean, he had so many matches.
I mean, the moment that split happened, he had the one feud with DiBiase, and then it just fell apart because he's.
And wasn't that a Dazzler match? I mean, that was a great match. I actually have rewatched that match within the last year, and it stunk. DiBiase, who of all people might be able to carry him to a decent match, was unable to carry him to a decent or interesting match.
I liked his presence, though, as Virgil. I didn't see a lot of Soul Train Jones.
As heel Virgil, you're saying yes. As heel Virgil for DiBiase.
Yes, as a valet who took bumps.
Yes, he was fine as that.
Yes, he had a nice scowl.
He also was completely unsympathetic.
Yes. Until it got a little racial, and then that's how they turned him, pretty much.
That's how they turned him. But yeah. Like, I mean, when it wasn't that, and DiBiase was just a scoundrel, and he would leave Virgil. You never felt bad for Virgil because Virgil always was getting his.
May he be having lots of meat sauce in the Olive Garden in the sky. I don't have a lot more to say about him.
He's I'll say one other thing. He is a good example of one of these older celebrities getting somebody to manage their social media account for them.
Yes.
Yeah. Cause like he was
like Iron Sheik.
Yeah. He wasn't doing that, but like, yeah, like Sheik, like he figured that out and that was smart. That was savvy.
Was he your favorite part of the West Texas Rednecks?
No, Mr. Perfect was in the West Texas Rednecks.
Of course he was. That's a correct answer. Although we'd also accept Barry Windham, too. In a developing situation that could have quite a negative ripple effect on upcoming events, PWInsider.com learned that the United States work visas for nearly 20 CMLL stars in Mexico are in the process of being canceled by the United States government. Once that happens, it could take months for new visas to go through the approval process and be issued. PWInsider.com is told that 19 luchadors, including Volador Jr., Hechicero, and Mascara Dorada, who have all appeared on AEW programming as late, as well as Blue Panther and others, are expected to be impacted and unable to perform in the United States. Well, Jeff, why are you reading that story? Well, because the AEW connection, it was rumored that Forbidden Door this year was going to be with CMLL. So that could be a bit of a problem. Chris, any thoughts?
It could be a bit of a problem, but they also could just book a narratively satisfying show, too, and not have to do the thing that they have to do whenever they do the Luchador Heavy shows, which is just, you know, it's what's El Aquarius doing in the Impact Zone.
Cubs fan 75, who knows a lot about this, says that this is more attributed to incompetence in the office and somebody forgetting to file paperwork and stuff, which rather than, you know, somebody behind the scenes like a Nick Khan or a Conan, you know, getting people. Somebody said, what if Conan was behind this? I go, do you think Conan has a lot of contacts at immigration? Is that what you think? But it's one of those things where it was a guy on his way out already, and then he didn't like do the prerequisite stuff. But it seems like a big deal, especially given that, you know, given the rules and the customs of Mexican wrestling, especially with AAA and CML both simultaneously working with AEW at the same time, although not allowed to appear on shows where the other's talent is. If you're building towards Forbidden Door, it would seem like you'd try and get those ducks in a row before even going to AEW. Maybe it's just me.
I don't know, man.
Okay.
I don't know.
Media call today for AEW Revolution, which happens on Sunday. We will preview in a moment, but interesting comment from Tony Khan saying that expanding to about 9 or 10 pay-per-views a year is his sweet spot. I disagree. I think it's far too much, and I think it's far.
6 is a good number.
4 was a good number too, if you could build to it. But the problem is, I mean, to me, if these are 10 pay-per-views, $60 a pop, I get that there's a lot of the AEW audience that doesn't pay for these things and still enjoys them. Don't get me wrong. I think it's too much. I do. I think 10 pay-per-views at full freight. And also, it's just, I don't know. I don't have faith in Tony. Tony doesn't do build well. I'm sorry. He doesn't. This time around, Revolution was the best he's done since the beginning of the company in terms of top-to-down card. And I understand that there's a lot of fans who don't give a crap about build. I get that. But it's also only 1/7 of your audience that's actually paying for pay-per-views. And while that's very, very good, don't get me wrong, I don't think you want to drive them away by, you know, upping their pay-per-view budget. What was it, 6 pay-per-views this past year for 360 to $900? Well, maybe, no, I'm wrong on the math there. 10 times 6, $600, my fault. I just don't know, Chris. I really don't know. I mean, it sounds like a good idea because it's what WCW and WWF, and it's what major companies do. They have pay-per-views every month type of a thing. I just think they have a lot of product out there right now that's kind of gone by the wayside as well. And it's one of those things where having a pay-per-view doesn't necessarily equate quality, although the matches will still be good because the athletes are still there. I'm kind of rambling here. I'm sorry.
No, the matches will still be there. I don't worry about that. I think $40 a month is a lot to demand from an audience. And
theirs are 60, I think.
60's worse. And that, I think, does run the risk of making the show even more sort of like have more of a spiraling inward trajectory in terms of ratings and viewership rather than a growing outward trajectory. Just because if there's this monthly cost barrier to watching this show, why am I watching this show? Also, man, $60 worth of value is just, that is, I think it's too much for any show economically to be asking.
Well, I do too, but the people who are going to be going for this probably aren't paying $60 a month. I'm just guessing. I'm just guessing there's a lot of people in your internet wrestling community that are torrenting or stealing the pay-per-view.
No, I'm not a dope about that. I understand how those websites work. Some of them are pretty neat, I would say.
Yes.
But that's sort of also evidence to the point that the economics aren't right here either. So I don't see. This is a business model that feels very nostalgic for 1997, 1998.
Yeah, I'm there with you. It's like if
And if all these people are stealing it, to go back to that time, right? Like, go back to the good old days when CDs cost $20 in 1998 money, and people were regularly stealing from Best Buy and Circuit City and all of these CD vending stores at a higher clip, because those CDs, when you adjust it for inflation, like, and then Napster shows up too, right? And immediately people stop buying CDs because the price point's too high,
right?
But
vis-a-vis the quality, there'd be one single on the CD, and then the rest would be filler stuff, and people would go, "Why am I paying this much just for the CD?"
But to time travel back to that day, you know, especially when, you know, you get your allowance or whatever, if I had $10, I might buy a CD that was $10 or like $7 or $8. It's just I wasn't going to pay $20 for a CD. And that's, I feel like AEW sort of doing that. I mean, even back in the day when we watched wrestling pay-per-views, we'd all go to a friend's house and everyone would chip in.
Chip in, you get pizza. Yeah. I think the thing that really turned me off for monthly pay-per-views, it was especially during the Monday Night Wars, where it felt like they were booking the pay-per-view to then resolve on the free television. And it just felt like it wasn't worth watching the pay-per-views when I was going to get the resolution of the angle on Monday Night Raw or Monday Nitro the next night. And what AEW fans will tell you is, well, you're watching it for the shared experience of the quote-unquote great slash five-star slash whatever great inflation Dave decides to do that month match. And at least for me personally, that's not worth it. I'm sure it's worth it for some people. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to dismiss people's fandom and what gets them off on wrestling. It's just one of those things that for me, it's a bit much if it's like, okay, I'm going to have another Bryan Danielson match here and on Collision. And, oh, this month he's going to, you know, they're not events anymore if you're having this much wrestling on free television and then just kind of doing a pay-per-view type of a thing. Like, what if I have 6 Blackpool Combat Club matches in 3 weeks and then they're fighting again on the pay-per-view? I don't find that special.
No, I think that that's reasonable. I also just am having a hard time getting into. I was thinking about Danielson and how he used to be a much hotter sort of commodity going into these shows.
I think we'll get into that. I think they may actually solve that problem, but I have my doubts. On this pay-per-view, we'll see. The theme of the pay-per-view for me is that Tony has to look at a couple guys and go, "I'm going to tell you to do the opposite of what you want to do." And hopefully talent will relent, but we will see. Ending the news, as seen on Tuesday, Sean Spears, not Ty Dillinger, was the man behind the promos of Three Faces, et cetera, et cetera. I was sure that was going to be a revamp of the Asian contingency with the Dragon Lady and her friends with the makeup and stuff like that. But nope, it was Sean Spears, back with the chairman gimmick of all things in NXT. Kind of hope Tully Blanchard shows up, but not on his trunks. But we'll see. Any thoughts? I think this is a lot of people going, this is a Cody call. I don't know about that. I know Sean Spears is big into training. He and Tyler Breeze have a school in Florida, and he was kind of a player coach in NXT before he left for AEW.
Yeah, my sort of thought is that he's like a player coach. Yeah. Here in NXT, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he loses this debut match to Rich Holland. Like, I don't see him as a major player or as like any sort of serious title contender. I just see him as like part of the mid card and part of the training core of NXT. And I think for that purpose, he's good. I think they always have the option by debuting him as Sean Spears. They always have the option to bring back the Perfect 10, which is. No, you laugh, but
they were chanting 10 during this cheer thing.
People love that Perfect 10 gimmick. They really did.
They loved, see, but I thought it expired when they finally did the payoff on the Royal Rumble. When he was a number 10 in the Royal Rumble. That's it. That's the pinnacle of your career right there. That's all you can do with that gimmick. Really. I thought.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, like, I guess theoretically, he could, win a championship, and this is a fruition of him viewing himself as a perfect 10, even when other people didn't. That sort of thing. It's like a power, it's an empowerment story, Jeff.
Okay, so you want him to be Carmelo clean. Got it.
I want to feel good about something.
Oh, we'll feel good that the news segment is over. We'll go into the lazy river of wrestling criticism, whatever we watched, whatever we saw, either current or former, and including previews and reviews of pay-per-views or premium live events, depending on how you do it. That's where we do it here. I suspect we'll have a lot to talk about Sting in this, but starting with, as usual, ice cold takes on events that happened previously. Elimination Chamber Perth last Saturday. Perfectly cromulent show, but absolutely no surprises. Thought the men's chamber was the best match of the show. Really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the tag team match with Tyler and Pete Dunne, although it's kind of comical to watch those two against Damian Priest. Women's match, slow start, but or the women's chamber, slow start. Tiffany Stratton, I think, is going to be headlining WrestleMania next year. Crowd loves her. They love the gimmick. She is tough. That's the thing that we don't give her enough credit for at times, is she's gorgeous, but she is a tough woman.
She's always shown that. Like the NXT matches, what she didn't show necessarily in terms of in-ring chops, she did show in those hardcore matches that she has a level of toughness that sort of is not necessarily belied by her look.
Oh, and also the stand and deliver in LA, where she gets on the ladder to do the senton off of it to the floor, and they don't catch her at all.
Yeah.
And she just hits the floor with a thud. She did. Look, she her first Elimination Chamber, she's going up to the pod, she's diving off people onto people. I mean, there's a certain level of a certain level of confidence there that you got to admire. And then I actually thought Becky versus Nia, or Rhea versus Nia, was better than it probably should have been. I mean, look, Nia Jax is never gonna set the world on fire. I thought she was actually pretty good. This seems to be very split. There are some people who really dug that match with Nia as the monster and Rhea working from underneath, and there are others who thought that Nia was her usual sloppy self.
This, I knew this going in, and it was, I tried to like basically look past my bias. This had the problem of being a very, very predictable show that I knew was going to be well worked, but
Yes.
it's sometimes part of the joy of watching wrestling, especially if you're gonna watch it live or even somewhat live. Like, when I don't watch it live, I'm watching it shortly thereafter, not having seen any spoilers or anything. Part of it, the joy is not knowing what's going to happen next.
Can you,
And
by the way, can you hear this ridiculous leaf blower that's it's outside my window right now?
no,
Okay, never
no.
mind then. Continue.
Yeah,
Sorry. I'm
yeah,
just laughing because I'm trying to hear you. I just.
yeah. And this show did not give me those moments of joy really at all.
No.
And that it made it a tough watch, even if I was like, they're doing
This is my fault for
Rhea
not.
and Nia was not bad.
You
It
could have
wasn't
fast
great.
forwarded about 45 minutes for that whole Grayson Waller effect crap, because that was utterly useless for the most part. There was a lot of filler in this show. I thought they were going to put a couple more matches on here. They only put a match on the pre-show, and that was Indy Hartwell and Candice LeRae versus the Kabuki Warriors to give Indy the hometown pop, which she got. She didn't take the fall, which is also nice of them to not do, but yeah, I mean, I agree. There are shows that are on paper where you expect things and they over-deliver. And then there are shows like this, which are on paper. You look at the match on paper, you know exactly what's going to happen, and it just kind of does what you thought was going to happen. And then you have to kind of question your life as to, well, if I knew that was going to happen, Should I have spent the time to watch any of these matches?
Yes, right. If everything on that show occurs as I think it's going to occur, what was the point of me watching that? And I get that that's not necessarily a problem for everyone, but it's a problem for me.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie. I find that very, I find those types of shows to be less interesting.
Yeah, much like, oh, if you follow me on Elon Musk's X, I had some opinions of Dynamite last night in terms of logic. And when I watch a television show, I want some logic in there. And everybody's telling me to shut up and just enjoy my wrestling. I can't watch television like that. I can't, if I'm going to turn my brain off for dumb, illogical, I'm going to go watch a movie like John Wick or something. I'm not going to watch wrestling for it necessarily. But we're going to go into our preview for 2024 Revolution. Sting's last match. I watched Beach Blast 92 last Saturday, just in the night before I was relaxing and go to sleep. That's the one. It also has the Steamboat Rude Iron Man match.
Okay, all right.
Has the Steiners versus Gordy and Williams, which is awesome. But it also has the Falls Count Anywhere Sting versus Cactus Jack match. And let me tell you something. Sting was game to go with Cactus Jack, who, this to me is actually peak in-ring Cactus Jack, but nobody in WCW had any faith in him or knew what to make of the guy because he was absolutely killing himself to get over here. This is when he'd do like the sunset flip from the apron to the floor type of thing. He did that with Orndorff at one point, but he also did it with Sting in this match. This match was awesome, and Sting was on his stuff. I'll put it that way, because he was flying around all over the place too. That match was awesome. What is overall your favorite Sting match? And I will also parse this by saying, without saying the 1992 War Games, which is the most fantastic War Games to ever exist.
I mean, you know, for
it's
me,
Vader, right?
It's going to be a Vader match.
It's
right?
going to be a Vader match, yeah.
And I'm trying to remember which one it is. I think it's the second match they had for the title where Vader ultimately wins on like a powerbomb, but it's almost like a desperation sort of thing. Like whenever he was squared up against Vader, they made him, he was never presented as like a weak baby face to Vader. The reason Vader and Harley Race were scared of Sting is because they legitimately thought Sting could beat him. And the reason they would cheat sometimes is because they legitimately thought in a fair match, it was possible, though neither one would ever say it out loud, that Sting could win a match against Vader. And I thought that Sting's dynamic against Vader was really good as the babyface. Like he made Vader really good. He was the perfect foil for him.
I
don't think I would have enjoyed Vader's career as much without Sting.
I think you're right on that. I love Vader, but my favorite opponent for him is still Muda. I love the New Japan WCW Super Show in 91 match. You know, they did certain things in JCP/WCW solo, usually for like the secondary title. Any combination of that Sting Flair versus Muda and then Dick Slater basically doing Terry Funk cosplay is pretty fantastic. I love Sting working from underneath against the big giant like Vader, but the fluidness of Muda matches when Sting was at his athletic peak and Muda was at his athletic peak, I enjoy those a little bit more, just by a hair. But but Vader's my number two in terms of his opponents. And then Flair would be number three. But Muda and Flair were always magic to me when they got together.
Yeah, no, Muda's a really interesting foil for him as well. And Sting had some good matches against Rude as well. Rude's kind of a sleeper.
Oh, yeah.
Opponent. Yeah, Rude's
no,
kind of a sleeper.
The solo matches against Rude, because this yeah. Rude was really...
He's a sleeper opponent for Sting, because they're both kind of body guys and similar. Yeah, like I like Rude a lot as a foil for Sting as well.
Yeah. Everybody remembers WWF Rude a lot more than WCW Rude. But when he came to WCW, Rick Rude had his working boots on here, and I think he doesn't get enough credit for that. And boy, you saying that, and even though I just mentioned the Dangerous Alliance thing, because I always think of, you know, I think there was a Sting Austin match in there that was really good at one point, or at least maybe a six man type of thing. But Sting Rude, although then I think about I think about terrible angles with Ole passing away. He's the guy who booked the Black Scorpion angle with Sting.
Hey, he was also the voice of the Shockmaster.
Of the Shockmaster. Yeah, I passed those on purpose because I don't want to remember
No,
those.
Those are things that I think actually add personality. No, I'm not even joking. I think they add personality to Ole.
but remember, Rude was the, is it the Phantom of WCW or something? He was a gift. Was it given to Luger or to Sting? I can't remember that. I thought it was to Sting. Where they do so he was doing magic tricks and stuff to play mind games with Sting.
This is the Black Scorpion.
No, okay, maybe, but I conflate that with the Phantom guy because remember I got Google this vamp for me real quick.
Okay, boy, what do I say about the Phantom or the Shockmaster? I think when we think about Ole Anderson, him breaking up into laughter on the
actually, you know, hold on, that whole Ole Anderson being behind the Black Scorpion angle is amazing for a guy who is all about toughness and realness, and then decided to go into Vince McMahon light type angles.
Yeah, like WCW were very bad at these Vince McMahon type angles too.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah, he was introduced with like a half black, half white mask with a cowboy hat. He's the WCW Phantom. He defeated Tom Zink at a Halloween Havoc, and I think then he went later to attack. He had Medusa as the thing. Who did he attack? Luger? Or did he attack Sting? I want to say Sting. Yeah, I just did. But yeah,
the
no, that
WCW
that
Phantom.
That U.S. Heavyweight Championship match against Sting was really good. And yeah.
Yeah. That
Sting
right, like,
Flair, of course, at Clash 1 was great too.
Yes. They did have good matches, but like because Sting's a little bit bigger than Flair. It, you know, like, I don't know, like, I didn't necessarily feel like he was always the best opponent for Flair.
See, and he wasn't having good matches, but for me, memorable was him and Rick Steiner being Eddie Gilbert's heavies in the latter stages of the UWF as part of Hot Stuff and Hyatt International. and then eventually your boy, Hollywood John Tatum and Jack Victory would leave the territory.
That began the
Sting as a heel was always kind of in, I mean, like he had no personality whatsoever. And you know, Rick Steiner was kind of, you know, he wasn't doing the goofy dog face gremlin, but he was still a little bit goofy at the time. But, I didn't watch a lot of TNA Sting, to be honest with you. I got to see Bound for Glory in 2009.
You know, TNA ended up being, I would say, on balance, good for Sting because it allowed him to become comfortable with the microphone in ways that he really never was prior to that. Even if he didn't love every single moment of TNA television, and that just means you have basic taste, the stuff that Sting did that was good on TNA was a marked improvement promo-wise, from the stuff that he was doing in the latter era of WCW. He really was stunted all throughout the 90s in terms of it being a promo.
Main Event Mafia Sting was a lot of fun.
Right? No, he becomes a much better promo as his career advances. And then he gets to WWE. He is a nostalgia act, but he can still go. He now has this ability to talk.
They blew that so bad, though.
Yeah, and they blew that bad. But, like, saw the potential.
I remember the thing I remember at Sting and WWE was how hyped. I mean, somebody made a fan poster because we were thinking that it was going to be Sting versus The Undertaker at that Mania.
That's right.
And the fan art for that was the most fantastic thing. And the match against Seth Rollins wasn't bad. Don't get me wrong. That whole feud was actually
a pretty good match.
Yeah, but the feud with the statue was stupid as hell. But that match with Seth couldn't be made up for with the absolute stupidity of the Triple H Sting booking, which became all about DX spiking the football on the NWO and basically telling WCW to piss off one last time. It's still one of the greatest pieces of misusing a legend I can think of in memory, because Vince still had to get his gigs. I often wonder if Triple H had had the choice, would he have laid down for Sting in that match?
I don't think so.
You think he was still full on, we were a superior brand type of thing?
Yeah.
You remember he was in WCW for a very short time. Mr. Terror Rising.
Well, he was also Jean-Paul Levesque at one point too.
Yes.
Like, he did put over a handful of people. Alex Wright was put over by Jean-Paul Levesque. Fun fact.
Original tag team partner with Regal.
So, yeah, also true. Also true.
He was going to be the original Blue Blood. This is why I'm so happy for this AEW run. Because he literally became Terry Funk for ECW AEW.
Totally. He was a great middle aged and crazy for them.
Yeah, and he's gonna be crazy on Sunday too, I think. But let's get to the preview now. Nine matches. And I don't think we've even included a lot of the preview matches that will come probably on Friday or Saturday. But we will start the Meat Madness, or whatever the hell they were going to call that. It's been canceled. It is now an all-star scramble match. Chris,
man, you're going to get rid of meat and replace it with scramble?
Yeah, pretty much.
Lame.
Although all the meat people, participants that were named, are in this scramble match, which begs a few questions. But Chris Jericho versus Wardlow versus Powerhouse Hobbs versus Lance Archer versus Hook versus Brian Cage versus Magnus, not Magnus, because that would be Nick Aldis, who's on SmackDown, versus Dante Martin. This will give me a chance to go into how Chris Jericho had one of the dumbest promos on last night. It should have just been endearing, and he's a babyface, and hey, my former partner's son is coming here to wrestle, and we're going to have a great match, and we're going to shake hands afterwards, and we might get a little bit heated in there, but we're going to be friends afterwards. Nope. Instead, hey, you know, Atlantis used to be my tag partner, and now I'm going to meet his son with violence, and oh, we're both going to cheat in this match in some way. And the ending to that match, I love that airplane spin move that Atlantis Jr. or whatever he's going by, maybe it's just Atlantis, was doing. But then to just put that directly into the walls of Jericho for a second, just for the towel to throw, was absolutely ridiculous. Powerhouse Hobbs is winning this match, so I don't care otherwise. It's just Jericho being Jericho and his instincts being bad there. Any thoughts on the scramble or Chris Jericho here?
Jericho just continues to do whatever the hell he's going to do from week to week. It feels like every 3 to 4 weeks, his mood changes on what type of story he wants to tell and how he wants to be booked, and we just do it.
I think that's AEW about 50% of it. Between, say, Danielson, Adam Copeland, Chris Jericho, Moxley in a way, maybe FTR, it's deferring to these guys and saying, what do you want to do this week? It's one of those things
it's what do you want to do this week every week?
Yeah. I just, it's interesting to me. Tag team match, FTR, Dax Harwood and Cash Wheeler taking on the Blackpool Combat Club of Jon Moxley and Claudio Castagnoli. I did watch Collision this past week. I loved that promo by Moxley and Castagnoli talking about how Harwood and Wheeler just kind of like watch old wrestling, but they're not really like old wrestlers or something to that effect. It was a nice little promo. I have FTR winning this. Who do you have?
Who are the teams again?
Harwood and Wheeler versus Moxley and Castagnoli.
I don't know. They could be repushing Blackpool. I'm gonna say Blackpool actually.
Really? In North Carolina, you're gonna beat FTR, huh?
I mean,
that doesn't persuade you at all.
I guess, like, I mean, given how Tony likes to book, no, than FTR. But like, would I beat FTR in North Carolina? Yeah, I'm not really that worried about Cash Wheeler's feelings at this point.
Oh, actually, you know what? That's correct. I mean, if this were Vince, he'd be punishing Cash and making him take the fall in North Carolina.
I mean, you know, couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Wow. Who are you typing to?
I'm looking up the card. I'm trying to, like, just get it.
Oh, I have the card from me. I'll just tell you it.
Okay.
We're good.
Okay.
Christian Cage with Killswitch Mother Wayne and the Prodigy Nick Wayne against Daniel Garcia in a singles match for the AEW TNT Championship. I'll let you go on this one.
I do not think Daniel Garcia wins here. I think Christian Cage with a bunch of gimmicks finds a way to overcome Daniel Garcia.
I think Adam Copeland comes out during this match. Copeland also lives in Asheville, North Carolina now. I think he, quote-unquote, accidentally spears Daniel Garcia. And I think this eventually, because I think Double or Nothing, I think the match is going to be FTR versus Christian Cage and Adam Copeland. So I think we're going to just start that heel turn here.
Okay.
At Revolution. That's what I'm thinking. I'm looking ahead a little bit. But... Yeah.
You think Edge is going to flip and join Christian again?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
But look, Daniel Garcia did the promo of his life last week. He's going to look good here. I just think he's going to get accidentally
There's going to be a lot of stuff going on here. He's going to look good, like he's going to overcome Killswitch, and he's going to look good like he's going to overcome Nick Wayne. And he's going to appear to have Christian Cage on the ropes, but there'll be like a ref bump and then Adam Copeland will spear him.
There's going to be a lot of overbooking in a lot of these matches.
Look at how many people are in the entourage for Christian Cage.
Yes.
It's Christian Cage with Killswitch, Mother Wayne, and Nick Wayne.
Yes.
That's a lot of extra people.
Also overbook Central. You can just put this alarm in here to me after a very good match, I think. Will Ospreay versus Konosuke Takeshita in a battle for Don Callis' love. Will Ospreay making his official debut in AEW last night, cutting a babyface promo and then saying, "Hey, I beat three of your favorite babyfaces and I'm a member of the Callis family." It was inexplicable to me. They should have just done the babyface turn here to go into the match. Who do you have winning this?
Ospreay wins, and then afterwards, during the hug it out section, that's when the Callis family all jumps Ospreay and says that he's not Callis family material.
I think Callis tries to screw Ospreay, and he comes up and he overcomes it. I think Callis tries to cheat on behalf of Takeshita, and then Ospreay somehow wins, and then Callis pretends he wants to hug it out, and then they beat him down. But I'm with you for the most part.
Yeah, maybe it's not that he cheats he clearly picks a side. Like, he's not like he doesn't actively cheat against Ospreay, but like he knocks Takeshita's foot off the rope enough to make it clear that he's chosen a favorite.
Yeah. Eddie Kingston versus Bryan Danielson in a singles match for the Continental Crown Championship. If Danielson loses, he has to shake Eddie Kingston's hand. Bryan Danielson on Collision this past Saturday had the greatest deconstruction of an Eddie Kingston promo that has ever existed. basically says, "Oh yeah, Eddie, you don't even take it seriously. You just go, oh look, there's the boom mic, there's the light. I'm out of here. I don't want to do this." Instead of cutting your promo, I absolutely howled at this, Chris. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, there are things that this iteration of Bryan Danielson does well.
There are things he doesn't do well because they can't decide whether or not he's going to be a babyface or a heel. And he's right. A babyface for most of the match, and then he ends the match as a heel like he did on last night.
I don't know what to do with this Bryan Danielson.
I don't either.
Eddie Kingston's going to win this match, but I don't know what to do with this Bryan Danielson.
I think Tony should look at Bryan Danielson and say, you're going to win this match. This is one of those ones where I think Bryan Danielson needs a title to help the company.
I think so, too.
I like Eddie Kingston right up until the bell rings, usually. I do. I think he's a great presence. I would much rather, again, I'd much rather see him be a brawler than a All Japan fanboy type of a thing, but I get that that's his gimmick in this company. But I think for the good of the company, Bryan Danielson should be a champion in it so that he can cut promos and make belts mean things. Not that Eddie Kingston can't, but Bryan Danielson is too big of a personality, and I know he's on his last run. Make as much money as you can by making him the biggest star in your company. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I keep going back to that. The idea that this guy isn't a feel-good nostalgia act in the perennial title picture, but rather this like weird tweener who like yells at you and then wrestles as a baby face and then like tells you that you suck on the microphone. And like, why do this with this guy? Like,
yeah.
I don't get it.
Oh, by the way, circling back to the scramble match, Wardlow's winning that, not Hobbs. What was I thinking? Sorry.
Yeah. Wardlow would be the pick. Yeah. I'm like looking at this. It's not gonna be Jericho. It's not gonna be Lance Archer. It's not gonna be Hook, although that'd be a fun one. It's not gonna be Cage or Magnus.
Or Dante Martin.
Or Dante Martin. So, like, then it's got to be Wardlow.
Yeah. AEW Women's World Championship, Tony Storm with Mariah May and Luther versus Deonna Purrazzo. I hope it's a good match. Ain't no way in hell Deonna's winning it.
No, I hope it's a good match because that's the only thing that would have made this program worth it.
Yes.
This has been a very stupid program with a dumb story. Deonna Purrazzo has not looked good on the microphone in the commentary booth, and even frankly she's looked fine in terms of execution in the ring, but has this really done anything to add intrigue to see more Deonna Purrazzo matches? No, this has been a lousy debut.
Again, this has been bad marketing because she's doing a heel gimmick while being the baby face here,
and Tony Storm is doing a weird baby face gimmick while being the heel here. Like, she's not Damian Sandow. She's more like Simon Gotch.
That's actually not bad. AEW International Championship, Orange Cassidy versus Roderick Strong. Boy, do I hate this Undisputed Kingdom. I think they're not a main event heel stable, no matter what they're going to try with it.
You could replace Matt Taven and Mike Bennett with anybody.
Yes.
Honestly, the thing that like makes this have any flavor at all is Roderick Strong, because he's the friend of Adam Cole. But like, Adam Cole's not this all-time great faction leader, in my opinion. No. I don't think his faction promos are that good. Matt Taven and Mike Bennett are not an all-time great anchor tag team to a faction. And then you got Roddy here, who is perfectly placed as the enforcer and a quality enforcer if you are building a faction, but he is of the members of the team the strongest piece of the unit. This faction stinks. I think Roddy does win this.
I think Roddy's winning this. I think they're going to start belting up a bunch of these guys.
They're going to belt them up. Yep.
Because Taven and Bennett, I think, have the Ring of Honor tag titles.
Yep.
And I think Wardlow's getting a title somewhere. I don't know if it's going to be the world title off of Joe, but I think he's getting a title somewhere so that they can then make these guys the centerpiece of the company, when I think the Callis family are a much stronger candidate. But That's me.
I think in his own company, Adam Cole is has a hard time being viewed as the third best faction leader. But, you know, you've got Callis, you've got Christian, you have, who else do we have in terms of faction leaders right now?
Danielson.
Danielson. Okay, yeah, he's not even the third best faction leader in his own company.
Okay. For the AEW World Championship, the greatest champion in wrestling right now, Samoa Joe, versus Hangman Adam Page versus Swerve Strickland. Again, two things that didn't make sense to me. Number one, the Swerve Strickland promo, where he's like, yes, you know, I've worked really hard, but don't forget, I also made an 18-year-old bleed. That's the baby face. Hangman did his part, although the knee injury being worked from the match last week makes absolutely no sense in terms of the plan kayfabe. The whole knee injury was in case he couldn't do the match, and I understand that. But in terms of faking a knee injury in the six man to then get to him attacking Swerve with a crutch doesn't make a lot of sense. But I actually enjoyed that part of it because I liked how AEW shot it, where they weren't tipping the hand on Adam Page, and they did the tight shot in on Swerve before he hit him with the crutch. I thought that was well done by them. And Joe is awesome on the mic, and I want Joe to win. And I think, now hear me out on this one. Adam Page takes a fall on purpose from Joe to keep Swerve from winning the title.
Wow. I could see that. I could see that's not the story I want, though.
That would anger people. And if it were the main event, I'd say there's no way in hell you'd do that. But I don't think this is the main event. And I think you're going to have enough goodwill coming out of this, out of the Sting match, to be able to pull something like this.
Adam Page taps out to, like not even in his submission hold. He just starts tapping on the mat saying, I give up.
Yes.
Like that would be, oh my, that would be an all-time heel finish in a triple threat where you see the other guy getting pinned and you look at the ref and you go, I give up.
I give up to Joe. Yeah.
I submit to Joe. Not even in a hold.
Oh, yeah, I even love that twist.
Yes. I give up. I submit to Joe. Yeah. Like, That's a level of petty.
That is a level of petty that I can get behind.
I know. That's a really good heel turn predicate. Like, that's a really, really good. That's fresh. I want this to go a different angle, although I like this one a lot as well. The angle I've been, I mean, I want this to be essentially a morality play of Adam Page, like, you are now trying to take shortcuts to win the title. And Swerve Strickland, you're trying to say you're a good man now, but you took a whole bunch of shortcuts to get to this point where you could start saying you're a good man. And like
the Eddie Gilbert redemption story when he was teaming with Simmons. Yeah.
Essentially, neither one of them are worthy of the championship in Joe's the Hand of Fate.
Joe is so awesome.
There's two different ways you could go with this, yes. And they're both equally good.
Yeah, I think so. I just don't see them belting Swerve in a three-way just yet. I think he's going to get it one-on-one so he can have his moment.
I'll tell you what, though. If they give the Adam Page, he screams, I quit at the ref. And that's how he like loses, or that's how he costs Swerve.
I will give a standing ovation to this match in my combo.
He screams, I quit to Joe. Yeah.
And then in the main event, Sting and Darby Allin with Ric Flair, ? Versus the Young Bucks of Matthew and Nicholas Jackson. Far be it for me to say this, but two things that I got in trouble for on the X. Number one, I just thought they should have created some new memory of Sting for this build, as opposed to going back to the last Nitro with the bats in the room, and then this highly convoluted and illogical plan to jump the Bucks using first Darby doing 1-on-2 and then Ric Flair doing the slowest, you can't even call it a run-in. It was a shuffle-in from him to turn on the Bucks and then Sting to drop from the rafters just to get the visual of Sting dropping from the rafters and Tony literally saying, "This is a moment." It was member berries spectacular.
This is a moment's actually a WWE-ism.
That's a literal
turn of phrase that they used. Because I remember one time Michael Cole doing a call at the end of a pay-per-view where he just screams, "This is a moment." And like, if you think about it, literally everything's a moment.
Very true. But yeah, and look, I want Sting to have a nice full portfolio as opposed to what WWE does with their legends. They can never get out of being their legend. It's always those moments only. They never evolve or anything. That's all I was saying. And I just had people jumping down my throat. Whatever. I don't care. Chris, the big question here. Sting is an old school guy. Is he looking up at the lights at the end of the night to the Bucks, or is Sting going to get the undefeated streak and retire as the only undefeated wrestler in AEW history to the fanfare of most? I also wanted to put in something. Oh, I forgot what it was. Damn it. I forgot what I was going to say. There's a point I wanted to make from that thing before. And I can't remember it right now. And if it comes to me, I'm just going to blurt it out. But go ahead, Chris.
I think Sting's winning. I think Sting and Darby win. And the next episode of Dynamite, he comes out and tells Darby he needs to find a new tag team partner. And like they do that sort of story. I think they're beating the Bucks. In part because the Bucks have chosen to be WWF. In this final run. So like the metaphor of the Vince guys beating Sting in the final match.
That's good.
Doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Sting's
got to beat Vince in the final match.
Yeah. My point was that plan was so bad. It felt like Darby Allin might turn on Sting in this match because he was just getting the crap beat out of him 2-on-1 and Sting never came to help him because he's up in the rafters doing that goofy stuff.
No, but this is almost like a reverse of the way that they did the WWF thing, you know, years ago with the NWO versus DX. The Bucks are basically serving as the Vince proxies this time.
Hear me out on this. Okay, so they do that. Darby picks Adam Copeland as his tag partner. And then Adam Copeland eventually delivers the tag titles to Christian that he doesn't earn.
That's how they deliver the tag team titles.
That feels like how they might do that. I don't know.
That would make perfect sense. Sting makes a mistake. He picks
another friend turns on Sting.
Sting, yep. Another friend turns on Sting. He's like, Darby! Because afterwards, he's got to go back to the yelling promos. Darby, I have a new friend for you. And then he brings out Adam Copeland. And then
they had that six man with those three. So that makes sense too.
That actually makes sense. Yeah.
I think Sting is going to ask to do the favors, but I think he's going to have to be convinced. And I just see him retiring undefeated. I think you're right. The metaphor / allegory is too strong here. We need to do a makeup for the WrestleMania thing. We're in Greensboro. I think Flair's going to pretend to turn on Sting one last time again, even though we just did this stupid thing on Wednesday. I think Sting's going to jump from something very, very high, and I hope he doesn't hurt himself too bad.
I want Flair to try to turn twice in a match.
I still want I love the idea of Flair, Arn, and Tully trying to beat down Sting and then being so tired that they're on hands and knees on the ground afterwards. That visual to me would pop me, but it's only me probably. But yeah, I think Sting retires undefeated. I'm gonna go with that on that. And for with that, that is the end of your Revolution preview. Is there anything in WWE or NXT that you want to hit on right now?
I think that Ilya Dragunov continues to be a highlight on a show that needs highlights desperately. Yes. On a regular basis. Ilya is just great character work. Melo's, this heel iteration of him is not great, but this is just a, you know, good solid placeholder match. I think Melo will lose in relatively short order, and whatever his story coming up next, that will be the thing. We already talked about the returning Ty Dillinger on this show. Outside of that, Luca Crucifino being presented as a babyface was baffling on this show.
Yes, yes. I have no notes for that. It's just baffling.
I actually did go back and rewatch parts of that match, because at the end, Vic is going, Luca Crucifino really showed us something during this match. And I was like, wait, he did? Okay, I've missed something. All right, let's wind that back. And I watched it, and basically all he showed us was getting bumped. So I don't really know what I saw from Luca Crucifino in this match.
I liked on Raw. I'd be remiss if I did not commend the New Day for wearing jeans to a street fight.
Yeah,
thank you for that. I also just like that little turn, and it's not a turn per se, but of Liv Morgan just looking at Becky Lynch for ruining her match and going, you know, not everything's about you, and walking away. It's starting kind of a, I'm not going to go so far as to say it's a Drew McIntyre type of a turn, but it adds a little depth there. It doesn't have to be a full on heel turn, but yeah, Becky is doing her dumb man shtick, which I don't enjoy. I love Becky Lynch. I don't enjoy the man for some reason.
What's interesting about the Liv Morgan move is that it could be the setup for Becky's heel turn too, where
yes,
her stuff, when you go subtle, you give two different possible plausible inflection points off of that scene. Now it could be Liv's going heel. It could also be that Becky's, you know, starting to become a dick. That person that everyone thinks kind of fondly of is kind of becoming an ass.
Well, that's an interesting dynamic, because everybody's going to be a babyface against Nia, because we saw Rhea, who is a heel, right, being a babyface against Nia. But if Rhea's winning this match at Mania, making Becky kind of the de facto heel in this, can they toe that line?
The Judgment Day are just not fully believed as heels, even though they're a heel faction.
Which is
hilarious, because Dom is the loudest boo of the building. But when, like,
when he stepped up to Gunther.
Oh.
Oh. You know what that moment was? I mean, did you ever watch Conan O'Brien when Triumph the Insult Comic Dog went down to the Star Wars premiere with the guy dressed as Spock, and he meets the woman who's dressed as Princess Leia, and everybody's doing their dumb lightsaber fights, and he goes, "What man will step up to be with this woman?" And this dorky guy says, "I will." That was dumb in this scene. Who's the biggest loser we could get to step to Gunther?
Oh, that was so... that visual, Gunther continues to be a highlight on this show, too. The promo on Jey Uso was some high-quality Gunther material, where he talks about feeling the title slipping out of his hands and then somehow retaining, and he goes, "I got to admit, I'm not perfect. But I'm the closest thing there is."
Both he and Drew had a good line. It's like, "You're hurt. I'm not missing WrestleMania. Who am I? CM Punk?"
There's some really nice character development on this show. Like, guys like Drew McIntyre and Gunther finding their voice with their already present ring chops, makes them really formidable talents on this show.
Well, not just that. It gives the card depth where you already know what the top of the card is going to do. They're going to run their roles. You know, Cody's do it now. Basically, has taken Kazarian's old Bullet Club Hunter gimmick or whatever for the Bloodline. And, you know, the top of the card is going to be the top of the card, although they need to give Bayley and Io something this week. Hopefully they will. But the middle of the card is intriguing, especially when you have Jay and Sammy and Dom all gunning for Gunther. I think that's kind of an interesting four-way right there. Yeah. They decided to do it that way. So, I mean, look, this WrestleMania card is going to be solid. I like Logan Paul versus Randy Orton. I think Logan Paul is gonna get posterized, much like Ricochet and Matt Sydal / Evan Bourne into an RKO by doing something very, very acrobatic and just having his head being right there for RKO. I think that's a perfect match. And I like the end of that and setting him up as the big heel with the brass knuckles. I thought that was kind of smart moving too. Now this card is, you know, two nights. I think it's going to be solid.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. They've got good feuds coming up for this.
Yeah, and look, is everything great? No, it's not. It's not. And is it a bit repetitive at times? Yes, but do they have some interesting things going on? Yes.
It's kind of like a mirror image of, well, I guess AEW is sort of the same way. Like, the top of the card's a little messy, but like when you get into the middle of WWE, they've got a lot of interesting stuff going on. I think Logan Paul and Randy Orton is a very solid mid card match.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, if that's what you've got sitting in the middle of your card.
And for his first Elimination Chamber, Logan Paul was pretty damn good.
Yeah, and I mean, look, if he had a good match with Adam Cole, I think he's gonna have a good match with Randy Orton.
Logan Paul and Adam Cole had a match?
Didn't they back in
No, you're thinking Pat McAfee.
Pat McAfee, that's right.
You know, we're eventually going to get to Pat McAfee versus Logan Paul in a celebrity versus celebrity encounter.
One thing I love during these shows is when they show the rankings for everybody on WWE during the matches. Like, see, there's a way to do this where it's not stupid. Where you, like, what you would do is you would talk about how the ranking system on WWE 2K24 is dynamic, just like pretty much every 2K game.
Oh, okay. You're being serious with
the 2K. Okay, I
thought you were taking a shot at AEW, which is now appears to have dumped the rankings 2 weeks in.
You know, hey, look, there's always next year, kid. I was talking about that. Yeah.
Okay. You're being serious. Okay. Go ahead.
WWF's
Sorry.
Or WWE's marketing for the,
yeah, for the
system.
For their video game, the corporate, like, synergy.
Yeah. Like, I don't think it's a bad idea in the sense that you could roll out weekly updates to the rankings. Like, cause they do that already on other 2K
Madden.
Games.
They do that on Madden.
Yeah. They do that on Madden. They do it on NBA 2K. Like, the other 2K franchises have this, and they've had this for like well over a decade. Like, back when I was in college, I used to get, like, the updated rosters for, like, when Charlotte still had the Bobcats. So, it's a minute ago. they rolled out Tyson Chandler getting traded to the Charlotte Bobcats, like, to put a moment in time here. So, WWE could do that, and then it sort of would make any of these matches sort of have some bearing on your rankings. You know, you at least, you know, advertise it and go, well, you know, if they lose, they will update this, and this might have an impact on what their rankings are in the game. Whether it does or it doesn't, it's at least just a way of pushing the product a little bit more cleanly.
Anything else?
No.
Okay, I'm out too.
No. Yeah, I'm out.
Enjoy your wrestling this weekend, kids. I am going to enjoy that Greensboro card. It's going to be sad to see Sting leave. Sting is possibly the last remnant of the, man, I can't wait to get cable so I can watch other companies and see more wrestling. Because I remember hearing when, oh, yeah, Home Team Sports plays this company called UWF. They have a lot of different wrestlers on there. I was like, can't wait to see that. part of my childhood slash teen years gone. I hope he kills it. I really do. I'm happy for him. He's had a great career, and he's made a lot of money. You can follow me on X at CrapGame13. You can just follow the show at ShakeThemRopes, all one word. You can follow Chris on Instagram only at Dr_Nove. That's DOCTOR_Nove. We are part of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. I also do other audio for Fight Game Media. This week I'll be doing the pre-game show with the Power Bombshells. And I'll also probably be doing a post-show live with Garrett Gonzalez over on Fight Game Media after Revolution. But every Wednesday I do a show with Paul Fontaine called The Dynamite Show. We thoroughly deconstruct Dynamite. Goes on live on YouTube about 20 minutes after the fact. Drops on your podcatchers the next day as audio. Chris has other interests that he's interested in. He'll tell you about them now.
Yeah, if you want guitar lessons, you can always hit me up on the Instagram. As Jeff mentioned, it's DOCTOR_NOV. You can also keep up with stories from my life as they go along here. Other than that, I just want to say thank you, Stinger.
That's good. Hey, kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling, too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that, too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network.